From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Prostate cancer is the most frequently diagnosed cancer and contributes to the second most cancer-related deaths in men in the United States and in North Carolina. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. But in 2015, the cancer that killed the most North Carolinians, lung cancer. In 2016, New Hanover County health officials reported that slightly more than 22% of deaths, the leading cause of death in both men and women that year, cancer. The majority of cases 1 year earlier in the county were from lung cancer. Breast cancer in women in 2015 was responsible for the second highest number of deaths. Colon cancer came in third, and prostate cancer was fourth. And cancer in millennials is on the rise, largely due to higher obesity rates. That's according to a recent study published in The Lancet and reported on by Cancer Updates Research and Education. Today, we'll look at what doctors are learning about causes, risk factors. We'll also learn about promising new treatments, including immunotherapy. And we'll hear about a clinical trial underway for those newly diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Joining me now are two local doctors who specialize in cancer treatment. Dr. Michael Papagikas is a radiation oncologist at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. Dr. Papagikas, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lindsay Prochaska is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer with the NHRMC Physician Group, Cape Fear Cancer Specialists. Dr. Prochaska, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you undergone successful cancer treatment? Do you regularly get screened? Tell us why or why not. Have you taken a genetic test that looks at your cancer risk? Call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Lindsay Prochaska, there has been some confusing back and forth in the media over the risks of breast cancer screening versus the benefits for a few reasons, partly the radiation that comes from diagnostics, partly the tendency to overtreat issues that may not have grown into anything that needed treatment. Where do you stand on this, and what is the latest best wisdom?
I mean, we certainly have enough data to say that mammograms for your screening, it's saving lives. I think that's first and foremost that, you know, I do strongly encourage that women get their mammogram, their screening. Since 3D mammography came out, really, you know, we know that that's a lot more sensitive in terms of, you know, picking up findings maybe so than the 2D were. So, yes, there is that risk that you're going to have something picked up that's, you know, maybe not a cancer. So maybe that's going to lead to a biopsy that we look back and may think was unnecessary. But at the same time, you know, you're weighing the risk and benefits of that. And, you know, the risks are pretty low in a procedure like that. And if you're finding a breast cancer, that certainly could potentially save a life. There are a lot of, you know, certainly thoughts about, you know, are you picking up something in someone who's very, very elderly that would maybe not ever, you know, if that cancer weren't found, would it ever bother them in their lifetime? And I think you really have to think about how healthy is the patient and their age. You know, if you have someone that's in relatively good health, though, I do think that their mammogram screening is necessary because the earlier detection is certainly why breast cancer is so largely curable at this point.
And at what age do you recommend starting screening and how often?
There are quite a few different guidelines for screening. I still think starting at age 40 and doing them yearly is, you know, most widely recommended. You know, if you have any family history of cancer, of breast cancer, then that certainly may sway things. And of course, if you have any known genetic abnormalities running in your family, that's a reason to, you know, either talk to your primary doctor or potentially even being a high-risk breast clinic.
Dr. Papagikas, there are new reports about new testing, new screening for prostate cancer that looks not just at total PSA, but looks at four markers and also works with this algorithm looking at age and other risk factors and that sort of thing. Why is the PSA test controversial in the first place? And what would you say is the latest best wisdom on that?
I would say what makes the PSA screening test, when it's used in indiscriminate fashion, challenging is that if you did a PSA and it is slightly elevated, and if that reflexively leads to a biopsy, that may lead to the diagnosis of what we describe as a clinically insignificant cancer. So a cancer that is present, but if left untreated, would not impact a patient's longevity or the quality of life over what we would provide as their best estimate for their life expectancy. And so the pendulum has swung a few times with PSA as a screening test, from everyone should start getting it to no one should get it. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has issued a number of sort of regulations, and it keeps flipping and flopping back and forth. So what they essentially did is they wanted to fix an over-treatment problem, and they may have induced an under-diagnosis problem. So what we're getting better at now is using PSA as just one tool to try to increase the likelihood that when we subject a man to a biopsy, we're going to find a clinically significant prostate cancer that then warrants some sort of aggressive curative intent treatment. And so there are urine-based tests that can help with this. There's additional blood-based tests that can do that. There are imaging studies. So a really common test that we're obtaining quite often now is what's called a multi-parametric prostate MRI that actually lets us look inside of the prostate and target our biopsy sort of more directed, increases the likelihood of finding the cancers that we want to find and sort of being able to ignore the ones that we don't want to find.
When you say ignore cancers that you don't want to find, give us an example of one that you might ignore.
Yeah, so if someone had a normal rectal exam, a standard 12-core biopsy, that's where the urologist to take six sort of random biopsies from both sides of the prostate, and if 1% of one of those 12 cores showed a tiny bit of Gleason 6 prostate cancer, and Gleason is a scale that tells us how aggressive it looks under the microscope, and they just had a marginally elevated PSA, and this biopsy occurred in a 76-year-old man, the likelihood that that would ever manifest anything other than worry for that patient is extremely low. So that's the kind of the scenario that we want to try to avoid.
Fair enough. Now, when I was looking at the latest numbers available from the CDC about the cancers that kill the most people in both the U.S. and North Carolina, I was surprised to see lung cancer come out on top with all of the public education that seems to have gone on around smoking. And is it fair to link that cancer, lung cancer rate to smoking in North Carolina and the United States, Dr. Prochaska?
I think it's fair in some ways because we know that smoking has, you know, such a huge impact on lung cancers. I mean, it's a known risk factor, a known causative agent. It's certainly, knowing what we know now, it's not surprising to us that it's on top, and I think that has a lot to do with when it's detected. I mean, people do not get a lot of signs early on with lung cancer, so to find, you know, stage one lung cancer, in my mind, you know, it's almost an incidental finding. So when people present and they're having shortness of breath and coughing, I mean, largely it's already in advanced stage. And so that's why once it gets to that stage, it's very, very difficult for us to treat with at least long-term outcomes.
So you're saying people with early stage lung cancer may not even be aware, they may not experience any symptoms?
Right. I mean, and of course, you know, where the lung cancer decides to present itself. I mean, if they have, you know, a small little cancer in the middle of their lung, it's, you know, likely not going to cause them any problems, and they would never really know.
So, yes, Dr. Papadikas.
I was just going to want to play off of that. The vast majority of patients with lung cancer, they're diagnosed at stage 3 and stage 4 at presentation. And historically, there's not been a good screening test to try to find lung cancer at an earlier phase. Annual chest x-rays have been used for a long time, but with very marginal utility. Within just the last few years, we do now have a somewhat effective screening test that is catching earlier stage lung cancer, and that is called a low-dose spiral CT. So it's a CAT scan of the chest, which instead of a x-ray, which gives us a two-dimensional picture, this actually gives us a fairly detailed three-dimensional picture of the lungs. And if you have a heavy smoking history, you're either a current smoker or you quit smoking, but it's been within the last 15 years, And if you have what we call a 30-pack year history of smoking, meaning you averaged one pack a day for 30 years, you meet the criteria, and insurance pays for this, and Medicare covers this, and you can get a low-dose, non-contrasted CT of the chest annually. And that's been shown to decrease mortality rates in the screened population. And the way it primarily does that is by shifting that diagnosis curve from stage 3 and 4 to stage 1 and 2.
So it seems logical that the earlier you diagnose a cancer, the more success you might have in treating it. Dr. Prochaska, can you tell us, I mean, we get the message all the time that colon cancer is one of those cancers that if you catch it early, it's almost always treatable. Is that accurate? And what are some of the other cancers that if you get them, or like there's no need to be afraid of the screening because if you catch it, it's more likely that you'll survive it?
I would agree with colon cancers. I mean, when they're caught very early, they are quite curable. You know, surgically, anything that we tend to think if we can surgically remove it before it has had a chance to really spread outside of its primary organ, then it's going to be much more curable than something caught at a later stage. I mean, of course, we come back to breast cancer. I think that's a prime example. You know, we have a known screening technique for that, and if we're catching these things early, they are, you know, largely curable. So, you know, that's one of just, you know, I think one other example that we have a good screening technique for.
You're listening to Coastline. We're going to learn about new technologies in cancer treatment in use in the Cape Fear region. We have two cancer specialists from NHRMC with us today, and they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of cancer treatment in the Cape Fear region. With us to answer your questions, Dr. Lindsay Prochaska. She's a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer with the NHRMC Physician Group, Cape Fear Cancer Specialists. Dr. Michael Papagikas is a radiation oncologist at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. And if you'd like to ask your own question on this Wednesday, you can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I did have an anonymous question come in about the number of deaths from lung cancer. Is it because of complications from lung cancer? In other words, cancer is often spread to the brain. And I see you nodding, Dr. Papagikas, and that can often kill people. What is there a link there between the spreading and the fatality?
Yeah, I would say that it would be incredibly rare for a patient to die from a localized lung cancer that did not spread to other parts of the body. So the mechanism of that might be a direct invasion of a tumor into an artery, and a patient would have a bleeding event or something along those lines. It's incredibly uncommon. The mechanism of death for most cancers is the tumor starts in one place and it begins to spread to other organ systems, and then it affects those other vital organ systems, and then that kind of leads to a spiral of things. So lung cancer, to take your example, it has a very high propensity to spread to the brain, the bones, the liver, the adrenal gland. These are sort of common places that it can spread. And if unchecked, and if, as the volume of disease increases in the body, basically it loses that fight, it shuts down, and it goes into an organ system sort of demise, and that's the terminal event from it. So it's usually not, patients don't die of breast cancer because of uncontrolled disease in the breast. They die because breast cancer is spread to other parts of the body.
Dr. Prochaska.
Yeah, no, I would largely agree with that. I mean, it's something that, you know, if you think of a lung cancer that, you know, it spreads you know, to any to switch to the liver, and then the liver stops functioning properly, and then even when it's diffuse within the lungs, and you start to get fluid and more shortness of breath, and then things just turn to spiral, like Mike was saying.
Okay, and we are going to get to these emerging treatments, specifically immunotherapy. There's so much talk about that. I mean, we're all seeing advertisements, national ads about that, but we also hear this is in use locally and may know people who have undergone successful immunotherapy. But first, let's go through the steps from the beginning. So a patient comes along because they either had a symptom or they went through a screening process and there was an abnormality. So what happens next? Can you take us through the stages, Dr. Prochaska?
Yeah, you know, I think it largely depends on what cancer type we're talking about. But, you know, once you get, you know, let's just say you have a symptom or you have a screening and it shows up and you have, whether it's, you know, a lesion or a mass, then typically we're going to need a biopsy of that so we actually have a tissue diagnosis. And so that is usually, a lot of times us as oncologists are not really involved until we get that tissue diagnosis. But once we have that, then you come in and really start to talk with your medical oncologist, your radiation oncologist. You know, I mean, again, using breast as an example, if someone comes in with a known breast cancer, we do manage that as well as most cancers in a very multidisciplinary approach, meaning that, you know, oftentimes you're seeing your medical oncologist, your radiation oncologist, and oftentimes a surgeon who's going to be working together to, you know, to deal with the cancer. So, you know, we're trying here in the community to do as many things, you know, as quickly as possible. You know, it's a very high stress environment when you get diagnosed with the cancer, but you'll usually see everyone and then put the pieces together on what should go first. Should surgery happen first? Should some kind of other, you know, chemotherapy or should your radiation therapy happen first?
Dr. Papadzikas, what do people need to understand about assembling a cancer care team and how to manage that? I mean, we certainly have heard, and this is not dinging medical doctors at all, but we've heard that the more informed a patient is and the more involved in their own treatment they are in from a management point of view, the better outcomes they often have.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head just with the use of the word team. So I think the first thing you want to do is recognize that the overwhelming majority of cancers, you're going to want to assemble a team, and you're going to want to assemble that team sort of early in the process before a whole bunch of things that can't be undone, you know, have occurred to you. And typically, that, you know, that team is going to be a surgeon of some sort or a surgical subspecialist, a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist. That doesn't apply to every single cancer, but for the big ones that we've been talking about so far, you know, that's generally the people that you want involved. And so I oftentimes, if I'm the first person, first oncologist that someone is seeing, I will describe that I'm just one of a number of people that are going to be on this team. You want to assemble this team. You want to feel comfortable with them. Hopefully, they've had a chance to do a little bit of research and reading about it, because I do believe that an empowered patient, a knowledgeable patient, leads to a better and more fuller conversation. So those are some of the things that I'd want patients to know if they're just being diagnosed.
Can you bring that into the concrete for us? Give us an example, and this is for either of you, of a situation in which a patient didn't really get proactive and assemble a team, and then steps were taken that, as you say, Dr. Papadzikas, can then not be undone. Help us understand what that looks like, possibly in a hypothetical scenario.
Sure. I would say, I primarily focus on prostate and lung cancer. And so prostate cancer is a disease that can either be managed down a surgical pathway with a radical prostatectomy, removing the prostate, or it can be managed with definitive radiation therapy. And so sometimes patients will go down a surgical pathway and sort of never be aware that there was this other entire sort of lane that could have, you know, treated their prostate cancer that wouldn't have required a surgery. And so I'll sometimes see those patients sort of further on down the road if their prostate's cancers come back. And even if surgery was the right choice up front, they can't help but have a little bit of a regret and kind of say, oh, well, you know, I wish I would have maybe had a conversation with you a few years ago. I didn't even know this was an option. So that always makes me feel a little bit bad when that situation happens.
Okay, and so we're going to talk about what some of those options are. Dr. Prochaska, did you want to add something before we get to a listener question?
No, we can start with the listener question.
Okay. So this person writes, my question is, if early detection is so important, why do doctors no longer do active physical examinations for chest, lung cancer, colon cancer, or prostate cancer. My doctor has told me they no longer do the exams I have gotten throughout my life during regular annual checkups. Can you clear up the types and examinations a person, especially after the age of 50 or 60, should be getting regularly?
I think that's a great question. And I will say that I think physical examination has, to some degree, sadly been lost over the last several years. I mean, I think that it is still very important, just as a routine exam when you're going into your physician, to be thoroughly examined with, you know, listening to your heart, listening to your lungs. You know, unfortunately, though, you know, a lot of times these things are not going to detect a cancer. You know, if you've got a lung cancer, again, if it's an early stage lung cancer, you won't hear that on physical examination. You can still have, you know, digital rectal exams, of course, for your prostate screening, which, you know, I still feel that that is done. But even, you know, breast cancer, for example, yes, you should be having, you know, your breast examinations when you go in with your physicians. But if you do have something that's so small, you would not necessarily be able to detect that. So, you know, in terms of the question after, did you say 60 years old?
Yeah. The person writes, especially after the age of 50 or 60, okay, what types of examination should that person be getting regularly?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you should still be having your mammograms, you know, your pap smears. You know, the guidelines are changing with that. I think it's something to really talk to your gynecologist about. But, you know, at least until 60 to 65 years old, largely most people are still having the regular paps, you know, pap screening exams and then prostate exams as well.
I agree with everything Lindsay said. I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of emerging cancer treatment technologies with two local cancer specialists. Dr. Lindsay Prochaska is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer with the NHRMC Physician Group, Cape Fear Cancer Specialist. And Dr. Michael Papagikas is a radiation oncologist at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by either calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. So what are some of the newer cancer treatment technologies, Dr. Papagikas, that are available here in the Cape Fear region that people might not have heard about?
So speaking sort of selfishly about my specialty of radiation
of
oncology,
course,
I feel comfortable to sort of talk on that first. So I would say the most exciting thing that we've had recently is it's a technique called stereotactic body radiotherapy, which is a mouthful. That's why we abbreviated SBRT. And it is using, maybe I can explain it better by explaining what it's not. Most radiation therapy, we give a very low dose each day, every day, Monday through Friday, 5 days a week, anywhere from 2 to 9 weeks, depending upon the cancer that we're treating. So some prostate patients would historically get 9 weeks of daily radiation. SBRT sort of flips that on its head, and we give very high doses in a very, very precise fashion over a very short period of time. So sometimes just a single fraction, sometimes three, sometimes five, you know, something in that neighborhood. And so that has been a big shift in the way that we have approached some early stage cancers. So for example, we're doing a lot of SBRT for early prostate cancer that's still confined to the prostate gland. And that's definitely sort of changed the landscape for early prostate cancer treatment. The other thing we're doing with a lot of our SBRT now, which it was completely not done when I was going through my residency training, is using SBRT to attempt to ablate sites of metastatic disease. And when I say metastatic disease, I mean cancer that started in one part of the body and it's now spread somewhere else. So in prostate cancer, a typical place for it to spread would be to the bone. So if somebody has prostate cancer, it spread to the bone, but it involves a very small number of sites. We might go in and actually zap each one of those discrete lesions and try to deliver an ablative dose of radiation therapy. That's a very new concept. It's a very new technology. It's kind of a new paradigm. It's a new way of thinking about those types of cancers. And we're able to do that treatment in the lung, bone, liver. Quite often we do that in the brain. So I would say that's probably the biggest technological advance that we've seen on the radiation delivery side.
Mm-hmm. What about immunotherapy, which we hear about so much now in national advertisements and locally? Dr. Prochaska, is that something that's applicable to breast cancer? And how does it work?
You know, it is. You know, it's easier for me probably because immunotherapy is really the new thing in cancer medicine in general that everyone's very excited about. You know, it's being used widely throughout multiple different cancer types, not just breast cancer. I would say kind of thinking of the way that immunotherapy works is it's really enhancing your immune system or unleashing your own immune system to go and fight the cancer in, you know, in contrast to our conventional chemotherapy agents that are, you know, sometimes not only hitting the bad cells, but also the good cells as well. So, you know, some of the cancer types, and this is just examples, melanoma, one of the cancer types where I would say kind of really get started, lung cancer, renal cell cancer, bladder cancer. There's almost no cancer at this point that's not seeing it in some way, shape, or form. I mean, prostate cancer, immunotherapy not really being used as much. And then, unfortunately, I do have to say breast cancer is not a place where it's being largely used. But places where, you know, breast cancers we have that are triple negative, and you may read that somewhere in the literature, where they're not driven by estrogen, not driven by hormones. They tend to be a little more aggressive in their nature. We do have some trials ongoing that are looking at immunotherapy in that setting and are having success. And we have a pretty recent data from 2018 looking at metastatic triple negative breast cancer where we're using some of the older chemotherapy agents in combination with, you know, enhancing the immune system through immunotherapy. And it is, you know, improving response.
And so how do you turn on someone's immune system to go after the cancer cells?
You know, we tend to think of these medicines that we term immunotherapy or immune therapy as checkpoint inhibitors. So they'll be essentially, if you think of a checkpoint on some of these T cells or immune cells that we have, and these inhibitors or immunotherapies will either turn on or turn off these checkpoints. And so that'll be a way that it, you know, when our immune system is told, hey, you know, attack things that are bad, but it doesn't always turn on because it would be attacking our bodies, just like people who have autoimmune processes like lupus. We don't want our immune systems always turned on. But in this situation, we want them to be able to go and turn on when they need to attack bad cancer cells. So it's, I think, in a nutshell, the best way to describe it.
Yeah. Dr. Papadzikas.
Yes, I would agree with that. One of the sort of the ways I describe it to patients is for a cancer to develop in your body, a whole bunch of things had to go wrong in sequence because our immune system is always sort of fighting and trying to keep us from developing these cancers. So by the time a cancer is developed, it has already figured out some ways to outsmart our natural immune system. And what we're starting to do with some of these immunotherapies is take a tumor that is kind of invisible to our immune system, and we make it visible again. We sort of pull the invisibility cloak off of it. Now our immune system that's always been there, that we can now rev up, and it sort of gives us this entire new avenue of attack. And so we had our big radiation oncology meeting in Texas back in September, and the entire sort of national conversation was about this sort of exciting concept that we can combine radiation therapy with immunotherapy. And so it turns out when you do radiation therapy to a tumor, you very much change its what we call microenvironment. And so you can take a kind of an invisible tumor and make it visible to the immune system. So when you do these drugs and you kind of combine that with radiation therapy, the hope and where a lot of emerging sort of research is looking at doing is, can we use one of 10 tumors that someone has in their body as its own internal vaccine? So can we get the immune system revved up by sort of zapping one tumor, giving some immunotherapy drugs, and then letting the immune system worry about all of the other ones that we don't go and chase with radiation?
How long does it take for a cutting-edge practice or an emerging technology like immunotherapy to come to an institution like NHRMC? At what point does it become a practice that you're able to use on patients or experiment with? And I don't know if I'm using the right language here, but Dr. Lindsay Prochaska.
You know, I would say first, it takes years from the time that something is created to go through multiple phases of clinical trials to where we know that it's safe to use in humans and we know that it's safe and then going to be effective for certain cancer types. So that in terms of years. But once we get to, you know, clinical trials that are happening that are giving us the data that we need that, yes, this is safe and effective, then I would say that it, you know, it pretty rapidly at that point, you know, comes to practice. I mean, I actually recently had a question about that. You know, do you have all the medicines here at NHRMC that you do at Duke or UNC? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, we may not have every single clinical trial, which is where, you know, your medicines are in the process of finding out these answers. Do they work and are they safe?
So those are, people go to those institutions for the clinical trials.
Well, we have them here as well. And so that's another thing that we were talking about earlier. You know, clinical trials are national. They're going on absolutely everywhere. You may have some very, very early phase research trials that are going to be at some institutions rather than others. But once it gets to the point that, you know, the FDA approves a medicine and says, yes, it works in this, it's safe in this, you know, use it for this cancer, we immediately will have availability to get that for any of our patients.
And so there is a clinical trial going on now. NHRMC is part of that, about addressing stage 4 lung cancer.
Yeah,
Dr. Papadakis?
Yes, we have I think we have a total of 40 clinical trials that are either actively accruing or are still following patients that have recently closed to accrual across a whole host of disease sites. The one in particular that that I'm sort of involved in and we're excited about is a clinical trial that is it's looking at stage 4 lung cancer patients. So these to be stage 4 means that it has started in the lung and it is now spread to some other organ in the body. And historically, the treatment for that would be chemotherapy. And we would do radiation therapy to a spot if it was causing a symptom or causing some sort of problem. But if it wasn't, it was just something we saw on a scan, we would leave it alone. Now we're sort of changing that around and being much more aggressive with that.
And I'm going to ask you more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. We're learning about emerging cancer treatments with two specialists from NHRMC today. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, you'll have one more segment to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Cancer treatments are evolving, and now even those diagnosed with stage 4 cancers are not necessarily facing imminent death. Two local specialists are with us and explaining some of these emerging technologies today. Dr. Lindsay Prochaska is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer with the NHRMC Physician Group, Cape Fear Cancer Specialist. Dr. Michael Papadakis is a radiation oncologist at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. You can reach us on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get that question or comment in. And I'm seeing emails starting to flood in now. But before we get to some of these, Dr. Papadakis, before we went to break, you were explaining about this clinical trial for those folks who are diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, a clinical trial is an opportunity for us to compare a new way of doing something with our current best accepted standard of care. And so a lot of people will think about a clinical trial as they're going to be a guinea pig, or they're going to get a placebo that doesn't have any effectiveness, and so they may not actually get their cancer treated. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And this clinical trial is a good example of what I'm talking about. So standard of care for stage 4 lung cancer has historically been systemic or drug-based therapy with radiation reserved what we call palliation, try to relieve a symptom, something along those lines. Well, emerging data has suggested that if we can go and be very aggressive and attempt to eradicate all known sites of disease, even if the disease has spread outside of the lung, there could be some benefit to that. Most of that data comes from small, single institution studies where there's no comparison. So to really sort of meet the gold standard of medical evidence, you need to do what's called a randomized controlled trial, where patients will go on a study and they'll be assigned to one of two treatment arms, and then they'll be treated according to that, where standard of care is the minimum for both arms. this study is an example of that, where sort of the standard of care would be drug-based therapy with radiation kept in reserve. The experimental arm, we actually go after in any sites of disease that were originally involved before a patient did their chemotherapy. We come back and we zap it with high-dose radiation, that SBRT that we were talking about before, with the hope being that we can actually alter the natural course of the disease. And in this study, in particular, immunotherapy is allowed and it's encouraged for those patients that have a disease or have certain tumor markers that make it available to do that. So I would say this is the kind of clinical trial that is really sort of shaking the paradigm of how we've thought about stage four cancers for a long time.
What are the barriers to getting into a clinical trial?
So I would say, I do a lot of clinical trial participation, and Lindsay does as well. It's multifactorial. So for these studies to have statistical validity, they need to be fairly rigorous in defining the patient population. And so I might see a patient who looks like they're a great candidate, but maybe they had a history of colon cancer 4.5 years ago, and they have to be 5 years out to be eligible for the study, something along those lines. So eligibility certainly is an issue. Sometimes it's physician driven. So it is an enormous amount of additional work to talk to patients about clinical trials, to put patients on clinical trials. And in busy clinical practices, sometimes that's just not where the priority is. Yeah. So that's an issue. I would say it's not the main thing, but patients, there's a certain amount of trust that a patient has to have to surrender some of these treatment decisions to random flip of a coin and an anonymous computer somewhere anonymizing you to one of two treatments. And so that's why I take so much extra time in those consults where I'm talking to someone about a clinical trial, is to really explain to them, here's why that randomization is so important. So I would say those are some of the barriers that I face, at least.
I'm curious, as we talk about some of these emerging treatments and different treatment options going into a clinical trial, does somebody's insurance coverage or their ability to pay for this have anything to do with the quality of their care? In practice, Dr. Prochaska.
I mean, a lot of times that, your insurances are going to be supportive of clinical trials, just as they would be a different standard of care chemotherapy that's not 100%. I mean, sometimes, insurances do drive that a little bit.
What if I don't have any insurance?
Is
that going to affect my outcome and possibly whether I survive a cancer?
Certainly the hope is not. I mean, in places like, New Hanover, certainly your bigger institutions, we have, support nets for that. We have financial assistance. We have ways that no one's going to go untreated. That's a little bit different in private settings and private practices that, maybe don't have quite as much support, but everyone should be treated.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know the insurance status of any of the patients that I see. And so I think we treat all patients sort of, regardless of their insurance status, regardless of their ability to pay. I'm fortunate in the sense that radiation therapy, it's a machine, it's software, we've already got it. I can apply it to anyone that I want to. If you're trying to get some drug from a drug company, then that's a sort of a different sort of economics, and there's a different dynamic at play there.
Right. And NHRMC recently hired, it was in 2017, I think, Joe Conway created a new position for dealing with disparities in health outcomes based on ethnicity and possibly whether someone's a member of the LGBTQ community, issues like that. Is that something that you've become more aware of in the last, say, year?
I mean, I think that we can say again that we're fortunate to not have to really think about someone's insurance status or ethnicity or anything at this point. I mean, I think it's important to speak to the community and say, no matter what your status is, please don't, shy away from getting help, because there's no person that comes through the door that you know, that I'm going to ask any questions about that. Like, I know that I'm going to treat them the exact same way that I would anyone else. And we have that support from our hospital system here.
In terms of clinical trials, one of the things we always talk about is generalizability. So you read the results of some clinical trial that's published in the academic medicine. Well, how easily can I apply that to my patient population? And that's where I think sometimes we need to sort of go out of our way to make sure that we're trying to accrue patients to clinical trials. We're looking at all sorts of demographics and trying to make sure that that patient population reflects our community population. So to kind of speak to like the LGBTQ sort of issues or any racial issues, gender issues, socioeconomic issues, all of those things sort of drive the train. And we want the patients that go on our clinical trials to represent those groups as they're represented in the community. One of the things I always comment on is pediatric cancers. We've seen incredible improvements in the survival rate for kids with cancer. And I think the statistic I saw is upward of 75% of all kids with cancer go on a clinical trial. So kids with cancer in the United States, we learn a huge amount from almost all of those kids. In general, the national average for adults that go on clinical cancer research studies is somewhere around 3%. So out of every 100 people that are diagnosed with cancer, you know, 97 of them, we're doing the best we can. We're treating them, and they might be informing me and giving me more experience and making me better, but they're not improving the science of oncology. That's how you do that, is by ratcheting up that clinical trial participation rate.
I think one other comment to that, too, from an interesting point, you know, when we look at our national cancer guidelines and it says, how do I treat breast cancer, lung cancer, the very first thing that you almost see on every guideline is consideration for a clinical trial. That's the very first thing. I think people sometimes tend to think this was an afterthought, or maybe I've exhausted other options, so now I'm going to be on a clinical trial. That I would say is very much the opposite of the truth. We should always be thinking about what can, you know, I have standard of care. Is there anything better in the form of a trial I can offer a patient?
We have an email. Michael writes, I'm 67 years old and have been hearing for many years about all the promising research for all sorts of cancers, and still we don't even have inexpensive tests to identify cancers in early stages or treatments that aren't as devastating as the disease. And he says, why on earth would someone choose oncology? Which is actually, Michael, something that we talked about before we went on the air today. And Dr. Prochaska, just very briefly, did you choose it?
I mean, again, oncology, you know, an awesome patient population, but I'm someone who likes to continuously have changing research. But I think to answer his question, though, it seems frustrating, and I think until you're in this field and you realize how much is going on and how much we are learning, it's hard to maybe wrap your head around and realize how many advances have been made. Things like immunotherapy in comparison to chemotherapy are so, so much more tolerable. People are not losing their hair. They're not at home sick. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I'm seeing people live for years with a very, very good quality of life based on the advances that we've made.
I would say one of the things that can, I think, sometimes contributes to that sense of pessimism is some of the overhyping that sometimes happens in the lay press. Is every few months there's a silver bullet out there that's going to, you know, cure all cancers. And we make the mistake of talking about cancer as if it's one thing. We even make the mistake of talking about prostate or lung cancer as if it's one thing. It's really just a collection of a whole bunch of diseases, you know, all sort of mixed together. So I sort of shared his concern. I wish that we had more cures. I wish we had better tests. There's an entirely emerging new area called liquid biopsies, where we're able actually to do blood work and look for circulating cancer cells and things like that. So that work's being done to try to kind of come up with these early detection issues and things like that.
So while cancer treatment technologies and cancer screening technologies are improving, are we also seeing more incidents of cancer? Is cancer on the rise?
I know our population is increasing, so it's certainly, I feel busier now than I've felt before. I don't know if
you're talking specifically about the Cape Fear region.
Yeah, so I don't know if the per capita cancer incidence rate is going up. I would say this, we have a lot more patients who are cancer survivors. So we're curing more people, which allows them to get second malignancies later on. Our cardiology colleagues are doing a fantastic job of keeping people from dying of acute, you know, heart attacks in their 50s. And so people who would have died young are now living into older age, and that's sort of the prime time to get cancer, so that's all kind of contributing to it.
So old age is a contributing factor. What else? Are there lifestyle factors? And this tips over into what may not be, you know, super hard science yet, but we read articles all the time about if you drink this many cups of coffee in the morning, you're more likely to get cancer. Oh no, just kidding. Another study shows that you're not. It actually is a risk, it's a protectant for cancer. So where are we now when it comes to lifestyle issues and the contributing factors, Dr. Prochaska?
You know, I think we've spoken to that a little bit earlier, too. I mean, we know smoking is linked to cancers. We know obesity is certainly being linked more and more to cancers.
And is obesity being linked to specific kinds of cancer or any kind of cancer?
I mean, I would say that you can read that it's being linked to a lot of different types of cancer. I mean, in terms of breast cancer specifically, there's some research on colon cancers. I'm not really aware specifically that lung, liver cancer and alcohol, certainly obesity and liver cancer. Environmental factors, though, again, I just don't think we have all the answers. I think there's something that's causing these cancers to be more and more, detected, but I don't have the answer.
I don't have the answer either. That's a bit, everyone's working on that. I share the same frustration with, you read the newspaper today and drink coffee, tomorrow it's don't drink coffee. So we undergo the same sort of whipsaw reaction that everyone else does.
What about issues like Gen X and the water supply? To make this really political and complicated, is that something that people in this region are really starting to look at, not just Gen X, of course, but any kind of PFAS or unregulated, potentially toxic compound?
I would say, I'm not an environmental engineer or an epidemiologist, but my general thought is, I want to have clean water. I want to know what's in it. That being said, to link these causative agents and to try to go back and to figure out what the increased cancer incidence rate is and tie that back to a very specific, a water contaminant, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. The process of developing a cancer, we see the very end stage once the cancer is actually diagnosed. There are often years of genetic and mutational changes that are occurring that often are not enough by themselves. Other things have to pile on to those genetic mutations before it ever turns into a cancer. So I don't know.
Fair enough. We have an email from Hap who writes, I attended a seminar in Durham last weekend by Spring Forest, and I'm going to mispronounce this. I'm sorry. Qigong as an Eastern healing tradition has a 5,000 plus year history compared to relatively new Western methods. So I'm not asking you to weigh in on the effectiveness of something like that, but you must get patients coming to you with all kinds of ideas about alternative therapies, Eastern therapies. What do you tell people about those pathways, Dr. Papagikas?
I try to be supportive of it, and I think what is a major driver for patients wanting to do that is a sense of control. And so we do all this stuff to them. We don't empower them that here's something you can do for yourself. So I think this sort of fills that void, and I try to be supportive of that as long as I don't know that it's actually working at cross purposes, what we're trying to do.
And are there alternative therapies that do work at cross purposes?
Yes. So for example, one of the ways that that radiation therapy works is through the creation of free oxygen radicals. It takes water and it breaks it up into these radicals. And that's what actually damages the DNA, and that's the working end of this radiation beam. So if someone is taking a boatload of antioxidants and they went to GNC on the day they got their biopsy results back and now they're taking a bunch of antioxidants, right when I'm trying to induce this oxidative state, that would be an example of cross purposes. We counsel people not to do that. You can take those antioxidants up to the start of radiation. You can resume them when we're done, but please don't take them during the time of the treatment.
Dr. Prochaska.
I agree. I mean, I tell my patients that, if there's something that you're taking, always bring it to me. Let's talk about it. Let's make sure that it's not going to have any negative effects. And otherwise, I'm going to support it.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Dr. Prochaska, Dr. Papagikas, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.